The light comes right on. It is 1:32 on Monday, February 4th, 2013. The House Resources Committee will come to order. Present this afternoon is Representative Johnson, Representative Wilson, Representative Seaton, Co-Chair Feige, and myself, Representative Sadler. We do have five members, a quorum to conduct business. I do recognize that Representative Mike Schnault is in the audience, and certainly everyone, please kill your cell phones, kill your TV, kill your cell phones, or it's Apple's. Just for the members' information in the audience, because we had a late start at 1:30, we would like to go as close to 3:30 as we can to give the sponsors a chance to give their presentation and answer questions. So if anyone has to leave at 3 o'clock, we'll understand. We have one item on the agenda today, which is House Bill 4, the In-State Gas Line Development Corporation, AGDC. And the sponsor, Representative Mike Hawker, is excused for the day, but we do have the co-prime sponsor, Representative Schnault, here to present the bill, as well as Representative Hawker's staff, Rena Delbridge, to walk us through the details. So without further what they call ado, would you like to come to the, and Representative Tuck has joined us. Come up and introduce yourself for the record. You want to both come up or just, you got it worked out. Mr. Speaker.
Mr. Chairman, committee members. First, I'd like to thank you for allowing House Bill 4 to be heard in committee. I had kind of a long, drawn-out statement I thought I'd come out with, but I'm usually not real good at reading off of paper. So, Mr. Chairman, I would just like to say to you and the committees that this is a long and tenuous process that we've dealt with for the last 30-some-odd years. That the state has actually been looking at how do we monetize our gas that's at Prudhoe Bay, and how do we bring it to Tidewater where it benefits most Alaskans. Now, we can argue about size, and we can argue about where it ends up at, but Mr. Chairman, I'm not here to argue about that. I'm here to try to explain, and I think that through the testimony that you'll hear is that we put together what we believe is a project that has the best opportunity to bring gas to Alaskans anytime in the near future. You'll hear arguments over it's not big enough, as I said earlier, it doesn't go to the right place. I've been trying to determine, and I've kind of looked it up, and I don't know of anywhere else in the world, if you were talking about building either a 24-inch high-pressure line or a 36-inch 1,440-pound line, that wouldn't be considered a big pipe. And while it may not be the magical 48-inch pipe, a pipeline of this size would do a number of things. It'd bring down the cost of utilities for the Fairbanks. It would improve the air quality, which is also hampers how Fairbanks heats their homes. It brings a long-term energy supply to the Cook Inlet, and I think along the way it helps rural Alaska by providing not only propanes, but possibly jobs and other things that are important to Alaskans. 3 years ago, I think it was three now, might have been four now, we passed House Bill 369, which AGDC has done everything that we've asked them to do and probably more. They're at a point right now where they need some tools in their toolbox to move forward. You have, a number of issues that Ms. Delbridge and others will bring up and discuss in whatever minute detail that the committee would like to talk about it in. But those are the tools that we feel are important to get Alaska to a open season to see if there really is a market out there to not only to sell our gas. So, you know, Mr. Chairman, I'd just like to say at this time, it's time for us to make a choice. We've told AGC to develop a plan, and that's exactly what they did. Now we need to give AGDC its next direction and the tools that it needs to carry out their mission, or we need to pull the plug. There's no halfway unless we're okay with driving up the cost to Alaskans will eventually pay for gas. And everything that every time we wait, it just costs us more. I think it's time now to deliver to the promise to Alaskans that we have gas through the rail belt system. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'll kind of set to the side, and we've got a presentation to put on for you. And Ms. Delbridge can certainly walk any member here through any portion of the piece of legislation and answer your questions. So with that, Mr. Chairman, thank you and the committee.
Thank you very much. Ms. Delbridge, if you want to come forward and school like your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Are we okay? All right. Representative Hawker sends his regrets at not being able to be here today and appreciates the committee's understanding. For the record, I am Rena Delbridge, staff to Representative Mike Hawker. We want to go ahead and give a little bit of a lay of the land for you today and explain where we are and how we got here and how we would like to move forward. To move forward, the sponsors have House Bill 4, short title, In-State Gas Line Development Corporation. You all know, more than maybe anyone, that Alaska has long wanted to develop Alaska's rich North Slope natural gas resource. Development brings a couple of things. First of all, it's seen as a clean, reliable, reasonably priced energy solution for Alaskans. This helps with electric and home heating costs. It provides economic development opportunities for communities, and gas readily available, secure supply could also provide for industrial development opportunities. We've also seen commercializing gas as a way to generate state revenue, both through production taxes and royalty gas, and through the future oil and gas exploration and development that a gas line can enable. Alaska's tried for decades. Developing our gas resource has been on the table since before the TAPS pipeline was completed. We've tried different things. Governor Tony Knowles worked to develop a gas line under the Stranded Gas Development Act. Governor Frank Murkowski, under Governor Palin, we saw a GIA. It hasn't worked yet. Part of the problem, in the sponsor's opinion, is that there's divergent interests. Alaska wants in-state gas developed to serve Alaskans and to commercialize a resource, whereas private industry, who we've always looked to support a large pipeline, needs to give a return to shareholders and make profit from a resource in the ground. It's no wonder to some that things haven't worked to date. We are talking about any gas line being a project with absolutely massive scale, massive costs, massive risks. They are mega projects. The state can be pretty prescriptive to date in demanding terms of a pipeline and size of a pipeline. Industry can be slow in responding to meet Alaska's needs. And quite honestly, markets change. Where we think we have a market for our gas in a large quantity has evaporated, windows close and windows open. Right now, alignment with the MOU group, where the governor is where the governor has encouraged TransCanada, ExxonMobil, ConocoPhillips, and BP to work together on a new project is promising. But the sponsors want to know, how long is Alaska willing to wait until we get gas to Alaskans? By 2010, as you heard the speaker say, there was frustration with a lack of progress on a big pipeline. Trying to make others develop a pipeline for Alaska on our terms was not delivering the results that Alaskans wanted. In 2010, members of the legislature took a fresh approach. They decided that Alaska can define what it wants and then do it ourselves. In-state energy use was the primary driver of that. There was a need to get gas to Alaskans. there was an idea to use the state as a catalyst to develop the early engineering and design work on a project that would demonstrate for the private sector that this could in fact be a pipeline that can work, and to demonstrate to Alaskans that an in-state gas pipeline could in fact deliver energy at reasonable costs. At the same time, in 2010, members of the legislature wanted to continue providing opportunities for private sector partners without asking the private sector to take on the project themselves.
Ms. Stelbridge, excuse me, for the record, I want to announce that Representative Josephson has joined us earlier, and certainly, sir, you're welcome to take a seat at the table.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So in 2010, members of the legislature wanted to essentially empower an independent entity to serve as the nexus for people that are interested in a project but to date in the private sector had been unwilling or able to take it on their own. Again, we go back to a mega project, huge costs, huge risks. They saw that the public benefit of doing so, of having the state serve as a catalyst, is the long-term deliverability of reasonably priced gas, again, for heating homes, generating electricity, providing economic stability and growth, providing opportunities for industrial development, such as a power source for large mines. And they also heard so clearly the imperative that we address in-state energy issues. So in House Bill 369 of 2010, there were a few broad goals. One, this bill built a team under Alaska Housing Finance Corporation's leadership. This team was to consolidate the state's gas pipeline work to date. There were a number of bits and pieces on an in-state line, an in-state route, permitting design, ways to extend the reach of that. This team was to consolidate. They were further to fill in the data gaps and decide what the optimal route would be for an in-state gas pipeline, and to report back to the legislature with a project plan. House Bill 369 passed with very broad bipartisan support. It passed the House unanimously. AGDC delivered with that July 2011 project plan. What we saw was that a pipeline for Alaskans is possible, even without a major export component. We saw that an in-state line could deliver competitively priced gas to the major population centers, specifically to Fairbanks and to South Central. We saw that a project will require those firm, long-term contracts for pipeline capacity in order to support the project financing. And AGDC also presented some items that would require legislative action. You heard testimony from Frank Richards with AGDC on Friday about those legislative recommendations. Again, AGDC needs the legislative authority to determine a pipeline ownership structure, to work confidentially with private sector partners, to operate as a contract carrier, to be able to decide rates and terms for shipping gas on this pipeline. And AGDC further needs recommended that the state waive property taxes and state land lease fees, which would help keep the pipeline costs down, and to provide sufficient funding. When we talk about sufficient funding, it's not simply a dollar value. The need for sufficient funding is to carry AGDC through a stage within its process. There's a great deal of difficulty in trying to secure the kinds of contracts that they need with certain engineers and designs for big-ticket items like a gas conditioning facility on the North Slope without the surety for that private sector partner that the state's serious about this and that the money's going to be there to support that contract through the length of the terms. That was in 2010. The sponsors are very pleased with the work that Alaska Housing Finance Corporation and now AGDC has done to progress this project. They appreciate the stage-gated and risk-based project management approach that AGDC has adopted. They like what they've seen in this plan. It does exactly what they asked AGDC to do. So now we have House Bill 4. House Bill 4 looks to empower one entity, separated as much as possible from politics, to forge ahead, to go carry out this plan. This isn't just about one line, though. The sponsors realize that with one line in place, the possibilities for Alaska are probably pretty endless. They've created a statutory framework for this corporation, then, to go through on their project plan, but also to be flexible and responsive and seize opportunities in the future. House Bill 4 also maintains momentum because delays definitely hurt. again, you heard Frank Richards testify on Friday that the project costs go up with inflation, $200 million or more per year that we wait. Those are additional costs that will be borne by the people using gas at the end of this pipeline, which will include Alaskans. Meanwhile, the South Central gas supply and South Central gas supply costs are increasingly uncertain. Fairbanks energy costs continue to be a devastating problem in that community, and their air quality problem has no real end in sight. As urban costs increase, rural communities also hurt more, and there's a continuing expectation for the state to offset high costs of energy in these communities, be it through direct assistance or the state's responsibility for covering energy costs for its own facilities and buildings. In drafting House Bill 4, legislation to allow AGDC to move forward and to generate an in-state gas pipeline for the state, the sponsors had a few guiding principles, if you will. They wanted to keep politics out of pipeline development. They wanted to let the markets essentially decide the real factors that will determine the way this pipeline looks. They wanted to build in maximum flexibility and options for AGDC. As you heard again Frank Richards testify, you start at the beginning with a project with a general idea of what the risks and the costs will be. As you spend money refining engineering and permitting and design, you get a better idea on what those costs and risks will be. We don't know at this point exactly what the optimal ownership structure is going to be to get gas to Alaskans at the lowest possible price. That is why AGDC needs that flexibility. They wanted to support a very aggressive, responsible schedule that's driven by the needs of Alaskans. They wanted to let markets shape pipeline decisions and to provide reasonable backstop for Alaska gas consumers. They wanted to include ways that the state can further keep the costs down and enhance a pipeline project's success. By empowering AGDC to go forward with the project, the state is making a de facto declaration that is in the state's best interest. And if this project is in the state's best interest, the sponsors would like to see the state assist it as much as they can. Finally, the sponsors wanted to respect the state's long-term policy of encouraging future development of Alaska's oil and gas basins through pipeline development. The state's always tried to make sure that those pipelines and that infrastructure is developed in a way that encourages additional exploration, additional production down the road.
So make sure if you're talking loud, you want to get a glass of water or something for your wet your whistle.
Am I sounding funny?
No, just want to make sure
okay.
I had a chance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So House Bill 4 attempts to strike a balance. The balance is between, you know, the free market forces that the sponsors are counting on to become partners to AGDC, to ship gas, thank you, and to make this happen, versus the tremendous needs in Alaska that need to be met. They need to balance the public sector support in the early stages in order to bring the project to an open season where economics are going to end up dictating the project's fate. That's what will decide what this looks like. So AGDC, under this legislation, would have significant authority and autonomy, but also a very clear mission. So they can use this authority and this autonomy in getting gas from the North Slope to Fairbanks to South Central at the lowest possible costs, and to other communities when they are able to at a reasonable price. AGDC is also poised very, very intentfully to shift gears if another project develops that delivers gas to Alaskans at the lowest possible costs without delays. There are institutional checks and balances, if you will, built into this legislation. Yes, a pipeline, but no, not at any cost. A pipeline under this legislation may not go forward unless there is a commercial project that has sufficient contractual support to finance it without additional state financial participation. Under this legislation, a gas line must deliver gas to Alaskans at a competitive price. So, very specifically, the plan going forward under House Bill 4, AGDC would first and foremost be empowered to continue work on the in-state gas pipeline. Of course, they require sufficient shipper support to finance a pipeline. They plan to hold an open season here in 2014, which will secure whether or not that is in fact a possibility or not. Their target date for gas flowing is 2019. They are to continue on this plan. But they are also to to work with TransCanada and the three producers, as the governor has requested, to see if those two projects can merge into one. This is uncertain. There's been no development commitment to date by TransCanada and the three producers, this aligned project group. However, they are continuing to meet benchmarks set out by the governor, and the sponsors are pleased by that. AGDC has been specifically identified as a partner to that by the governor and has certain assets that it brings to the table, including an aggressive timeline for Alaskans, assets such as an existing state right-of-way lease, a final EIS for a federal right-of-way. These are valuable assets that can help any project. At the same time, House Bill 4 would equip AGDC to be prepared for participation in other frameworks. There is still a license issued under AGEA. If a lower 48 export line is built, AGDC can shift gears and consider a spur line to serve Alaskans. And finally, once a main in-state line is complete, AGDC under House Bill 4 is in position to evaluate other pipeline opportunities. These could be lines off of that main line connecting other communities and industrial developments to gas. These could be other standalone Alaska gas pipelines, albeit of a much smaller scale, wherever those are in fact needed and proved commercial. And so now we're getting into the actual legislation, if you will. We can break House Bill 4 down conceptually into these three main things. House Bill 4 provides a statutory framework for AGDC to serve as Alaska's natural gas pipeline corporation. House Bill 4 maximizes the state's efforts in pipeline development, and House Bill 4 resolves regulatory uncertainties while supporting the future development of Alaska's resources. So first of all, establishing AGDC as Alaska's gas pipeline entity. The sponsors believe that AGDC, as a subsidiary corporation of Alaska Housing Finance, has done a wonderful job. Housing Finance has proved a wonderful incubator, if you will, for the subsidiary. It was a good place to start, a good place to position something while it studies the issue to see if something is in fact possible. Now that we know that it is, it's time to do this right, time to be serious. So this bill moves AGDC from its present location as a subsidiary corporation and makes it a standalone public corporation of the state. AGDC would be located under the Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development for administrative purposes only, which essentially means for budget requests and appropriations if necessary. Under this legislation, AGDC would be governed by a 5-member board with expertise in relevant fields. Members would be appointed by the governor and confirmed by the legislature. The relevant fields that we're talking about are specific to natural gas pipelines, to finance, and to large project management. This legislation also provides very clear transition language. The sponsors wanted to ensure that in no way does repositioning AGDC's as a corporation interfere with or delay any of the work that's ongoing or any of the progress on a pipeline project. The legislation clearly states AGDC's purpose, and I know we've been over this a couple times, but it's worth knowing how explicit it is. To advance an in-state gas pipeline as described in the July 2011 project plan, with modifications as appropriate, to make gas available to Fairbanks, South Central, and other communities at the lowest rates possible, and then to develop pipelines that serve utility and industrial customers at commercially reasonable rates, and to develop pipelines offering commercial rates to shippers and that offer access for shippers who produce gas in Alaska. The legislation provides clear statutory abilities to AGDC so that it can function as a corporation and accomplish its purpose. This is a very long section of the bill. It's more than 20 pages. You'll find a lot in there that's very boilerplate. A corporation needs the explicit authority to adopt a seal and to enter into contracts and to hire people, for example. There's also a lot, though, that's very relevant to AGDC's particular mission. AGDC can enter into ownership and operating partnerships. It can create subsidiaries, including a subsidiary to market gas, be that the state's royalty gas, if that is if state royalty gas is shipped in this pipeline, or also to market gas on behalf of others. AGDC could issue revenue bonds limited to AGDC's own backing only to finance a pipeline. AGDC could enter into confidentiality agreements that are necessary to participate with private sector shippers, with partners in owning the pipeline, and in financiers. They could keep other information confidential, like field studies, data, tariff models. These are assets that AGDC is developing for the state with the state's money. The intent is that while they are of relevancy to a project, the state gain maximum return for those assets.
Actually, thank you, Ms. Elbridge. Representative Wilson, because we have such a long presentation, I'm going to allow questions as we go through, but with due regard for progress of the presentation. Representative Wilson. Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The being able to keep confidential some of their findings, and I know in a lot of other areas across the state, after so long of a time, then it becomes the state's purview to have that information. Did we leave that in with this also? How does that work?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, there's nothing explicit that states that in here, except for that at which point in time AGDC as a corporation ceases to exist as a corporation, all of its assets are remanded to the state. At this point, the real concern is that the data being generated for this project be confidential through the time that this project is built. We could certainly discuss with you ways to be more explicit about that, particularly when there are other interests out there who may find this beneficial. It's important to protect the value of that asset right now.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
Actually, I've got a question here, Ms. Elbridge. Let's see, the second bullet point, third bullet point, is it usual for a developer of such a large project to basically be its own financier? I don't know mega project financing that well, but I'm going to ask the question.
I believe, Mr. Chairman, that with revenue bonds, it's normal for a project to be able to go out and bond for the financing for that project, as they are the ones that are pledging the revenue from their project back to those funds. Continue? Okay. AGDC also, under this legislation, is able to exercise the state's existing power of eminent domain.
I'm sorry. A question, Representative Feige.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The power of eminent domain is, I guess, could be interpreted as being fairly heavy-handed. Why would AGDC need this power?
Representative Feige, through the chair, the power to exercise eminent domain for a pipeline project exists within state statute. What the state would be doing by granting AGDC the power to exercise eminent domain is essentially to delegate that power to AGDC so that AGDC itself can go ahead and exercise it rather than having to go back and work through the state channels, creating the potential for delays and additional costs. Now, AGDC is only able to exercise the state's power of eminent domain along the same lines that the state would be able to exercise its power of eminent domain. And there are thresholds built into statute that require having had good faith negotiations with landowners in order to, those must have failed in order to go to this route. It also, though, requires then that the landholder is receiving fair compensation for the property that is taken under eminent domain. House Bill 4 also exempts AGDC and INGDA from the State Procurement Code and State Personnel Act. It exempts AGDC from the Executive Budget Act, and it applies public official disclosure rules to AGDC board members so that AGDC board members are, in fact, required to make their disclosures. And I'm sorry, I didn't put this on the PowerPoint. Forgive me. One of the other things, pardon me.
Representative Wilson has a question on this point.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Could you give me some? I'm sure that some of the reasons are that sometimes you can get things from the private sector easier than with other ones, but if you could give the reasons for each of those so it's on the record.
Absolutely. Representative Wilson, through the chair. The intent is still that they get things from the private sector, and in fact the legislation requires AGDC to, as possible, give a preference to Alaska for procuring services, for procuring materials, for hiring, to work through, for example, the existing programs that the state labor department has in place to train and then to fit employees with the position. The exemption from the procurement code essentially means that AGDC would not have to go through this particular channels that we do require. When procuring items, they need to be flexible. They need to move quickly. They need to be able to go out and work through whatever terms that they can to get the absolute best prices on things. That might not always look like the state procurement code procedures. We also have a situation where we're talking both materials and contracts, contracts for services. Much of AGDC's work going forward is going to be for contract personnel, and they're going to need the flexibility to move quickly and to move into the very best expertise that they can. I'm happy to ask Frank Richards with AGDC to come up and elaborate a little bit about what that will look like for AGDC.
Your call.
Yeah.
Okay.
Representative, actually, on this topic, I'm going to ask a brief question first. And Representative Tuck, understand if you're exempting ANGDA and AGDC from state procurement codes, you're going to try and encourage Alaska hire any position to encourage veteran hire or veteran preference for your, veteran procurement preference.
Mr. Chairman, there is nothing in the bill that does that, no. Alaska Native corporations and local government entities are specifically mentioned.
Okay. And could you refer to the section there? I've read the bill, but it's swimming a little bit.
Yes, sir. That's in Section 1, Legislative Findings and Intent.
Thank you.
And I believe you'll find that particularly on page 3.
Outstanding. I won't hold you to that, but thank you. Representative Tuck, question?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And then if you can give some examples on how the state procurement code right now doesn't fit with the flexibility that you desire.
Representative?
Down the road, not at this moment, but down the road.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, we'll have many, many such topics. I anticipate that question. Representative Feige?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. These provisions that you're asking for, does this essentially put AGDC on the same, into sort of the same situation as the railroad?
Representative Feige, through the chair,
on the same basis as last
there are differences between the railroad and the Permanent Fund Corporation and housing finance. I am not sure what specifically the railroad exemption is from the state procurement code. The railroad is exempt from the Executive Budget Act. Alaska Housing Finance Corporation is partially exempt.
Okay, fair enough. Proceed, thanks.
Okay. If you will, the one other point in their corporate maze and abilities is also is a requirement, is a shall, and that is that AGDC needs to publicize the results of an open season when they have successful bids for pipeline capacity. This was modeled largely after FERC's rules governing an open season for Alaska. Once AGDC has signed commitments from people to ship on their pipeline, they need to tell us publicly who those shippers are, how much capacity they have contracted for, and over what length of time. And in a sense, this is a reassurance to Alaskans that says these are legitimate shippers. They're actually bidding up the space required in order to fill up this pipeline, and they're going to promise those contracts for a length of time that is reasonable and lets things work for us. Okay, House Bill 4 also maximizes the state's efforts in gas pipeline development. Again, the sponsor's position is that the passage of House Bill 4 and direction of AGDC on this new mission is a de facto finding that an in-state gas pipeline is in the state's best interest, and therefore the state should be supporting this pipeline as much as possible to reduce delays and to keep costs as low as possible. So to do this. House Bill 4 takes the Alaska Natural Gas Development Authority, which has worked on a number of gas development projects over the years, and redefines them as a subsidiary corporation of AGDC. This bill then adapts ANGA's purpose to serve as a gas marketer. A gas marketer is a little bit like a gas aggregator. A gas marketer might buy gas at the top of the pipeline, pay to transport it, and then sell it to multiple entities at the bottom of the pipeline. The House Bill 4 encourages the Department of Natural Resources Commissioner to work with AGDC, particularly a gas marketing subsidiary, to make the state's royalty gas available for shipment through an AGDC pipeline. As a note, this is to make that available for shipment, not to give that state royalty gas to AGDC or a subsidiary, and not to sell it to any particular person at any particular price. That's a decision that the DNR commissioner makes. House Bill 4 then also limits the judicial review of state permitting decisions and authorizations in order to avoid delays once you've started construction.
Hey, Mr. Overage, a question, again, not knowing the details of this kind of stuff, I'm going to ask you, would this establish ANGDA as the sole venue through which this gas could be marketed, or a marketer or the marketer?
Mr. Chairman, ANGDA would be able to serve as a gas marketer. AGDC has the ability to create subsidiaries for any purpose that it needs a subsidiary to do in conjunction with carrying out its mission.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Does ANGDA have the expertise to be a gas marketer?
Representative Johnson, through the chair, I don't believe that there's anything left of ANGDA at the moment. ANGDA doesn't have, I believe, any existing board members or personnel or staff, and so the intent would be that ANGDA could be recreated in order to have the expertise to carry out that function.
It looks like a follow-up coming.
Why?
Representative Johnson, through the chair, ANGDA was of course created by the voters through initiative in the early 2000s, specifically to build a gas pipeline by, I believe, 2005. Of course, that didn't quite work, and they have taken on other tasks as directed or at their own initiative over the years to try and be involved in gas development in Alaska. I'm sorry, was the why?
I'm not sure. If they have no staff, they have no purpose, they've got a name, why would we not? I mean, are we just going to have the marketing and just name them ANGDA?
Representative.
Political purposes, just to. Does it serve any real good purpose?
Representative Johnson, through the chair, AGDC doesn't need ANGDA to market gas.
That's, thank you, Mr. Chairman. That's pretty much all I needed.
Thank you. Representative Wilson's question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question is limit the judicial review of state permitting decisions and authorize us to vote to avoid delays. So can you, I don't even know for sure what the process is for the judicial review. And I surely understand trying to get the permitting process going. And so the because each department is encouraged to make sure that we can get this going, is that why that's been limited?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, judicial review is important, and it gives people a voice. So do the public processes that the state of Alaska requires when issuing permit decisions and giving project authorizations. The intent is not to disallow any of that public process, but to avoid the kind of lawsuits that come late in the game and are often filed very specifically to delay a project. Generally, that happens when a court then issues injunctive relief and basically calls a halt to a project, construction, until a lawsuit is settled out. Now, that lawsuit may or may not have any foundation in the end or not, but the project has been stopped. Delays are incredibly costly and difficult. It is important that this limit is strictly of state permitting decisions, lease issuances, authorizations. People would still have that public process before that decision or authorization is made in which to participate. The limitation is it restricts complaints to, I believe, the Superior Court and prohibits injunctive relief so that a court cannot delay the process. If someone feels that this violates their, that if someone has a challenge to this particular provision, they have a set period of time after this bill passes to challenge that. And then if they feel that the state has made some sort of a decision or authorization that violates their constitutional rights, I believe they have 60 days from the time that that state decision is made to challenge it. So we maintain avenues for legal challenge, but we restrict the boundaries of those.
I think that makes perfect sense. Thank you.
Absolutely.
Ms. Delbridge, correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't this kind of post-sanction judicial limitation a feature of all the gas line proposals we've seen in Alaska, at least in the last decade? And wasn't it a feature of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline authorization?
Mr. Chairman, you're correct. Well, I don't know about all gas pipeline projects, but okay. When the state has decided that something is in the best interest of the people of the state and therefore wants to go through with it, it's reasonable that they are stepping in, is the theory. Yes, TAPS did enjoy limits on judicial review, and I do believe that that's also part of the Alaska Natural Gas Pipeline Act of 2004, the federal act.
Proceed if you care.
Carry on. Again, to maximize the state efforts at gas development, this legislation would waive state and local property taxes during pipeline construction. It would require state entities to cooperate with and share information with AGDC. That means that AGDC requests from other state agencies would receive priority, except for AGEA requests, which have already claimed priority. It also means that AGDC and state entities could enter into confidentiality agreements to share information if that information involves a third party that needs to be protected. The legislation calls on the state to provide water, sand, gravel, and other non-hydrocarbon natural resources to AGDC. AGDC, under this legislation, needs to pay the usual prices to the state for these resources, but the costs cannot be included in the tariff base for the pipeline and passed on to shippers. And finally, the legislation directs the Department of Natural Resources to waive annual fees on a state right-of-way lease for AGDC. This is currently costing nearly $200,000 a year.
Regarding the first point there, is it true that the proposal from AGDC would waive state and local property taxes during operations as well? So is this, I seem to recall reading something that the recommendation would be not to have this pipeline subject to state property taxes at least. So is this limitation just during construction or during operation or both or either or what?
Mr. Chairman, there's a little bit of both. The bill specifically waives property taxes, local and state, on a gas pipeline that AGDC has any involvement in. A part owner, for example, or perhaps AGD simply finances the pipeline. State and local property taxes would be waived only until that gas is flowing, I believe. However, in Section 3, which is the corporate statutes, corporate authorities for AGDC, as per most of the state's corporations, it's not generally reasonable to have one state entity paying taxes to another, and so all property of the corporation is exempt from state taxes. And so the answer to your question is that it does a little bit of both, and what ultimately happens would depend on the ownership structure of the pipeline, whose property it is.
Thank you.
So those are ways that House Bill 4 tries to maximize the state's efforts at the natural gas development. And again, the third big part of House Bill 4 is an attempt to resolve regulatory uncertainties. Regulatory uncertainties, not knowing how you're going to be regulated, add risk. Risk adds costs, and risk can also deter private sector participation. AGDC needs to know up front how a pipeline is going to be regulated. That's something that their private sector partners are going to need to know. Therefore, House Bill 4 establishes a framework within the state to accommodate a contract carrier pipeline. House Bill 4 does that through two avenues. It allows natural gas pipelines to operate as contract carriers through changes to the Right-of-Way Leasing Act and also through Regulatory Commission of Alaska oversight. What House Bill 4 also does is reinforces, again, that long-term state policy that gas pipeline development, you know, should be fair. It should offer reasonable access to new and future developed shippers. It should encourage the future development of Alaska's oil and gas resources.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wilson, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Could you tell me, the RCA has some changes. Can you tell us what those changes are?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, will you hang with me just a couple more slides? I think we'll be right there.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, thank you.
Sure. Representative Feige.
Regarding the allowance to operate as a contract carrier, it seems to me that if you have an open season and you fill up all the space in your pipeline, then there's no necessarily any provision for any future and the results of any future exploration or even existing reserves that would be able to get space in a pipeline and get a route to market. Assuming, and this may depend on how much is actually in an open season, how much interest is shown, you're limited to half a bee a day by another statute. What if you get commitments for more than half a bee a day? How do you allocate that that space in that pipe? Do you start a bidding war with the tariffs, trying to bid them down or bid them up? I'm not sure exactly which way that would work, but that could be somewhat problematic here.
Representative Feige, through the chair, you are correct. Right now, an AGDC pipeline would be limited to 500 million cubic feet a day, and that is under the terms of AGEA. The precise method of allocating capacity initially is something that AGDC needs to determine and to make known to the Regulatory Commission and to the people bidding on its pipeline. Instead of us prescribing that, we are going to ask that AGDC make that part of their commercial contracting. But it is something that must be included in those contracts and in those terms.
And getting back to the tariff, I guess from first blush, I would think that would tend to bid the tariffs down, or would it bid the tariffs up?
Representative Feige, through the chair, I'm not sure that it would end up bidding either way if people are signing contracts without knowing who else is also signing contracts at the same time. I think that the scenario of a bidding war is probably quite likely if people are there knowing what other parties are wanting to do and on the terms that they're wanting to do it. The sponsors are certainly very cognizant of the fact that there is a limit right now on pipeline size. However, an open season is a year and a half away. It's difficult to know if the state will still be a licensee under AGEA at that time.
Okay. And Representative Schnell.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, if I could make a statement on that. What a terrible position the state of Alaska would be in if we had people stepping up to the plate and bidding more gas than what our proposed project would handle. I think that you would see us step in as a state and make the right choice, which would be to allow any of them to get into it, and we would just size appropriate.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Vishnell. So an open season is an expression of interest. It's not a binding commitment to ship.
Mr. Chairman, an open season in this case would be binding. What you're doing in an open season is it's a period of time at which potential shippers and then the pipeline carrier come and they talk about terms and they negotiate things and they talk a lot. And the carrier is doing that with a lot of potential shippers. And then what comes out of an open season would be something called a precedent agreement. and a precedent agreement is binding. It's usually conditioned, and so it's a contract that says we have a deal, provided that you get 1, 2, 3, and 4 worked out. The terms that come on a precedent agreement, some are very, very standard. They're things like, you know, this comes in within a certain plus or minus of budget. This doesn't face project delays. You are able to iron out whatever uncertainty might be left. Other things are perhaps more particular to a given project or a given shipper.
Okay. I'd like to note for the record that Representative Garen Tarr is with us by the miracle of the telephone. Representative Tarr, can you hear us okay?
Yes, I can. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. If at any time you have questions, just knock on your mic. We'll listen to you and let you come in. Thank you for being with us.
Okay, thank you.
Please proceed, Rena.
Thank you. So one of the big questions, of course, that people have is why a contract carrier? Why do we need to do this? Shippers on a pipeline need to know that the space that they are reserving by signing a long-term commitment to buy that space is going to be available. Those firm, uninterruptible contracts are the way gas pipelines are typically financed. The future income that's promised through those contracts secures the revenue bonds. House Bill 4 establishes that contract carrier status while providing for expansions in the future. This comes back, I think Representative Feige had made some comments about what happens to people down the road. What happens if they want in on this and you find gas somewhere that you didn't know you had it and you want to ship? I have to caution this by prefacing it with providing it does not violate any of the terms of AGEA. This legislation and this regulatory framework absolutely provides for expansions. A pipeline would have to expand when it's presented with a commercially reasonable expansion project. Expansion can happen in a number of ways. It can be as simple as adding compression to a compressor station. Once you've done that a couple times and you're feeding as much pressure as you can based on the pipe strength through that pipeline, then you go to something called looping, and you kind of loop another arm of the pipeline along with it. There are opportunities there. The carrier has to expand if it has a commercial opportunity presented. The difference in a expansion under our contract carrier status compared to, say, a common carrier pipeline is that the existing shippers, an expansion cannot make the existing shippers pay more than their contracts allow and that they are at the time. So it can't raise their rates.
Well, I understand that the extra capacity by looping and compression is based on some technical parameters in general in industry. What is the likely parameter? How much more capacity could be squeezed out of a 24-inch line?
Oh, Mr. Chairman, I wish I could tell you that. It is going to entirely depend on that particular line's engineering, how much pressure can go through, how much compression's already in space, in place, the size of the pipeline, and...
There's got to be some absolute limit technologically, and I think Representative Feige has a comment on this.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Early in the presentation, you mentioned it was a 1,440 PSI line, 36 inches in diameter. What's the spec going to be on the pipe? Wall thickness specifically and type of steel?
Representative Feige, through the chair, I would leave those questions to AGDC and their engineers. I believe Frank Richards is here today. If you'd like him to have him come up a moment and...
That'd be great.
Okay.
Yep. Ms. Richards, please come. Give Rena a chance to breathe. And
thank you, Mr. Speaker. Appreciate the chair. For the record, my name is Frank Richards, engineering and government affairs manager for the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation. Representative Feige, for the pipe spec that we were looking at with our new lean gas case was 1,480 PSI. It was an ANSI 600-pound class, approximately 0.52 inches wall thickness.
Say ANSI 80?
ANSI 600 pounds. So we're looking approximately about an X60 or X65 grade pipe.
And for the record, could you spell out the acronym there for the secretary?
Mr. Chairman, I will have to get back to the committee on a common term. Mr. Representative Tucker.
Yeah, I think it's American National Standards Institute.
Very good.
Sure.
That'd be fair.
Good job.
Yeah.
That's one
less
wrong. Not very often.
So, Mr. Richards, before you take off there, let me ask you the question of you asked of Ms. Delbridge. Any idea what the expandability factor might be? It gives you an extra 0.2, 0.5, double it? Any estimation at all?
Mr. Chairman, again, under the provisions of AGEA, we are limited to designing an in-state pipeline to the $500 million limitation. If we wanted to look at the ultimate capacity of that pipe, we could certainly do it at the request of the committee, but we have been very specific in our designs only to limit it to the $500 million.
Okay. So it kind of contradicts what you said about the expandability via compression and so forth. So.
Oh, Mr. Chairman, if I may, certainly pipelines, as Ms. Delridge has said, you can increase the capacity of the flow through the pipe by adding compression. We as a project, though, have not done that because of the provisions of AGEA. That's what I'm saying.
Fair enough. Questions you can't ask. Okay. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't know the answer to this.
That's
so I don't. I would we be violating the terms of AGEA if we asked you to do that? Before I want to ask you to do that, I want to answer to that.
Representative Wilson, through the chair, I would think that that might be a question to your legal counsel.
I'll wait.
Okay. We actually happen to have Tina Grovier online, who is an attorney with AGDC. Ms. Grovier, if you'd like to weigh in and not exposing yourself to any risk, but address the question best you can.
Through the chair, just to make sure I'm understanding, the question is whether by asking AGDC to calculate how much capacity could be or how much volume could be run through the pipeline, would that be a violation of AGEA? Is that the question?
Yes.
Right answer.
I'm the attorney.
It's a technical legal term. I think I would like to look into that a little bit, and I would need to talk about how much is sort of publicly available information that could be acquired from a different source, for example, as opposed to actually causing AGDC to go through those calculations, which would cause some concern, at least in my mind.
Thank you. Follow-up question, Ms. Wilson.
Thank you very much, and I think maybe we should get that information, too, from another source also. So before I go further with that, I do want to know what the ramifications would be, because we sure don't want to do that. So
right. I would encourage you to err on the side of caution so we don't scotch anything. We don't need to. I'm sure this will be up before us again, so we'll have the opportunity to get that considered legal answer. Thanks, Ryan.
Thank you.
With that, Ms. Delbridge, if you want to resume your presentation, thanks.
Thank you. So we talked a little bit about why we need to have a contract carrier pipeline. To be clear, perhaps it helps to explain that in a common carrier pipeline, you can have firm commitments, but typically those commitments are interruptible. And so the concept behind a common carrier is that when other people want to come in and have room on that pipeline, then those people that have existing space are sort of prorated. They're moved aside to make room for the new also. And that's one of the difficulties here that we need to get past by enabling contract carriage. It is very much a matter of financing here. It is also, though, a matter of the end users of the gas. Oil pipelines tend to kind of feed into something, a hub, a trading hub, storage tanks, whatnot. Gas pipelines often deliver gas that's used immediately for an ongoing power source. A power plant doesn't typically store a lot of the gas that it's getting off a big pipeline. If you're powering an industrial mine, it also may not store very much gas. People need to know that the amount of gas that they're counting on coming through that line every day is going to always be there. And as discussed, we enable contract carriage two ways, through the Right-of-Way Leasing Act and through Regulatory Commission oversight. So with the Right-of-Way Leasing Act, when you go to the state and you want a right-of-way lease across state land, you obviously have a lot of lease terms, but included in those are a set of covenants in statute that you need to agree to if you're going to get this lease. a lot of those covenants right now are things that are very nuts and bolts. You're not going to abandon a pipeline. You're going to abide by the state's rules. You're going to take all the necessary precautions to avoid any environmental degradation. Some of the covenants, however, reflect common carrier principles. And those are covenants, then, that we've adapted in order to reflect contract carrier principles. So the contract, what we've done with House Bill 4, then, is create sort of a subset of covenants for contract carriage, so that whether you're a common or a contract pipeline, you are still subject to all those nuts and bolts. Those are the same. If you are a contract carrier, however, you are not subject to certain covenants that reflect common carrier principles. But contract carrier covenants under this bill still require a pipeline to provide connections with other pipelines and facilities. The contract carrier does that per contractual terms. The contract carrier covenants in this bill still require expansions, but on commercially reasonable terms, where you're not adversely affecting the rates that your day one or existing shippers are paying. And then the contract carrier covenants in this bill still require a pipeline to ship without discrimination. And I believe it's actually phrased as without undue discrimination, and that's to accommodate the principle that certain classes of shippers will probably be treated a little bit differently than other classes of shippers. If you're shipping a small quantity, your terms as a group of people shipping small quantities will probably be similar, but they will probably be different from the shipping terms of someone shipping large quantities or a group of people shipping large quantities. That's what the undue discrimination is all about. So that's through the Right-of-Way Leasing Act. And then we also enable a contract carrier gas pipeline through the Regulatory Commission of Alaska oversight. Now, the Regulatory Commission of Alaska, or the RCA, regulates as told to do so by the legislature. Currently, the RCA has statutes that direct it in how to regulate public utilities and statutes that direct it in how to regulate pipelines. Their pipeline regulation is generally been used for oil pipelines. It reflects common carriage principles. There are some provisions in there for a North Slope pipeline that have never been tested and are a little bit unclear as how those may work. Therefore, this legislation created another direction of regulation for the RCA, adding a new chapter to law, 4208, and that is to regulate a contract carrier gas pipeline. Within this new regulatory section, we try again and walk that balance between enabling a private sector, commercial, contractual-based project to go forward and protecting the other parties that might be involved, such as public utilities buying gas that shipped on a line like this or that ship gas themselves, and also making sure that the protections for the ultimate consumers of that gas are still in place through the RCA. And so the contract carrier regulatory framework requires that the pipeline carrier give kind of a baseline package of rates and terms. That's called a recourse tariff. That's made available to all interested parties of shipping gas. And then you can negotiate the specific rates and terms off of that baseline. The point is to make sure that all parties have had the ability to all get in on the same terms.
And for clarification, when you say to all interested parties, you're referring to all potential shippers or both sides of the shipper-supplier agreement?
Mr. Chairman, yes, shippers. People signing contracts to ship gas on the pipeline. The structure requires the RCA to decide if precedent agreements made after that open season are just and reasonable. The premise in this bill is that contracts that are entered into willingly by two parties are just and reasonable, or else we wouldn't have agreed to sign this contract. There are some checks and balances there. The RCA is to take a much stronger look at contracts that are made between affiliated parties. They are to take a stronger look at contracts that do not include that recourse tariff and that are made between entities that have an existing relationship.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Does the RCA now usually deal with common carriers, and this would be a little new twist to it, you might say?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, the RCA currently regulates public utilities and public utility pipelines, and has the ability to regulate also under a chapter for common carrier pipelines. It specifies pipelines in general. It does not regulate things like field gathering lines within an oil and gas development, that kind of a situation.
Okay. Thank you.
The contract carrier provisions in this bill also try and provide certainty and protection for our public utilities. It's unknown whether or not public utilities will actually commit to long-term shipping contracts on this pipeline. They may buy gas that is shipped on this pipeline by that marketer or aggregator subsidiary that we talked about earlier. We have created a standard of review to where contracts involving public utilities can come to the RCA for approval before they're finalized. And that lets the public utility know that they are going to be able to recover the costs that they're agreeing to incur by their involvement with this pipeline in their rate base that's passed on to consumers down the road. This legislation allows that precedent agreements need to be filed.
I'm going to back you up before you flip to the next slide. Would the regulatory authority change given the ultimate destination of gas? If some of this gas were to be exported outside of Alaska, outside of the United States, would that change the regulatory structure or requirements? Is there a contract carrier?
Mr. Chairman, that's possible. It's not certain. It depends perhaps somewhat as to what percentage of a pipeline would be carrying gas to export and to what destinations. I am going to ask if Tina Grovier is still available to go into a little bit more depth there as to when the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission may decide to regulate on behalf of the state.
Great. Thank you, Ms. Grovier, if you heard the question.
It's Tina Grovier, yes, through the chair. To the chair, actually. Basically, my understanding of the FERC regulation is that if it is exported to the United States, that is, for example, to the West Coast, that would be a circumstance where FERC would elect to exercise or would exercise jurisdiction. My understanding is other locations, such as export to Pacific Rim, it is not subject to FERC jurisdiction.
Okay. So again, just to clarify, so if gas was within the United States, FERC would be involved, but if it was exported outside the United States, it would not.
Correct. There are de minimis amounts where if it's a small amount of volume and it's got some intrastate that they could elect to not regulate, but generally I think it's fair to say that if it goes to the West Coast or to the United States, that yes, FERC would be involved.
Okay. Exclusively, or would it just to the percentage that it was being exported? Would RCA have any piece of this for gas that was used inside the state solely?
It's my understanding that it would depend on the volume. FERC could, I believe, exercise complete jurisdiction, but it would depend on the volumes and the intrastate component and how significant they evaluated that to be.
Okay, we might follow up with you later on this point, but as I...
Certainly.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm sorry, because you kind of described this, but I've already forgotten it. So if you can kind of go into just a little bit more detail on the precedent agreements.
Yes, Representative Wilson, through the chair. Are you asking about precedent agreements in general or how they would be handled by the RCA?
Well, exactly what are they?
Okay. What happens is that the pipeline carrier puts together a package, and it sort of says, we have this much space available, and we're offering these rates and these terms if you want to buy some of this space and reserve it for your gas. And so that's sort of the basic package
that's
that they put out.
Season.
Pardon?
That's in the open season when they get that?
Sure,
yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
And so then what you know, people that think that they might want to commit to some of this gas go and they talk to them and they discuss the terms and the conditions, and then they come to an agreement. And so your agreement out of that open season is referred to as a precedent agreement.
Okay.
And that agreement is kind of, it's binding, but it's conditional on things stated in the agreement. Once those conditions are ironed out, the precedent agreements evolve into something called a firm transportation contract or firm transportation service agreement. That usually happens at the point of project sanctioning. That's when you've seen that the pipeline carrier did meet all of those conditions that you put on your contract, and so you're signing the final deal.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes, absolutely. Mr. Chairman, if I could, in this regulatory statute, we've been explicit that it applies to an in-state natural gas pipeline that's not subject to FERC jurisdiction, just to make clear that there's no attempt to take jurisdiction when it's someone else's.
So that your basic assumption is in-state. Okay.
Okay. So the regulatory structure allows that those precedent agreements that Representative Wilson was asking about are filed with the RCA. Those agreements, when they're filed with the RCA, are filed confidentially. This is because there are still terms in those agreements that are being worked out, and they need to be subject to those commercial protections. Once those precedent agreements become final contracts or firm transportation agreements, then those are made public at the RCA. However, information can be withheld from that publication if it threatens the commercial position of one of the entities involved in the contract. The regulatory framework requires that the pipeline get a CPCN. It's a Certificate of Public Convenience and Necessity. Larry Persily, who you've all heard talk about these things, often calls it a building permit, which is a great description. That's the RCA saying that this pipeline is needed, that the people proposing this pipeline are able to actually build it and maintain it and operate it the way that they say that they will. We do put in a few special terms for an AGDC pipeline in getting this building permit, and those are intended to reflect that state-sanctioned mission. If the state is telling AGDC to go out and build this pipeline, then the state has already decided that it's in the public interest. And that's one of the findings that the RCA generally has to make on its own in issuing that building permit. We also decide that if the state is equipping AGDC to go out and do these things, then AGDC is financially capable of doing this. The state has made sure of that by passing legislation giving it that authority and ability. And again, that's another one of the findings that the RCA would usually have to make in issuing a CPCN. Now, the RCA will still have to make sure that AGDC is technically fit, willing, and able to do this pipeline. They need to make sure that AGDC has the right expertise and personnel on board to do this and to do it right. This legislation further allows the RCA to step in and intervene in pipeline management, et cetera, when there's a dispute that can't be resolved between contracting parties and that threatens the public health and safety. If there is some dispute that has not been accommodated in contractual dispute resolution methods, and a power plant in South Central Alaska is somehow not going to get its gas in 2 weeks in the middle of January because of that dispute, the RCA has the ability and the authority to step in and make things, set the terms, iron it out.
Is this a change from, does this deny access to the courts in this kind of dispute resolution?
Mr. Chairman, I don't believe that it denies access necessarily to the courts. The concern is that if there's a threat to the public health and safety, there's no time. There's no time to go through courts. There's no time to do anything else. Someone needs to take charge, iron things out, and act promptly in the public's interest. Other disputes that are between contracting parties and that don't have an immediate threat to the public health and safety, we require within this legislation that AGDC's contracts with its shippers specify and include dispute resolution methods. We're not saying what those have to be, but they need to have included those in the contracts. And so disputes between contracting parties that aren't a public health safety issue will be handled per the terms of those contracts.
I guess the way this is being presented, my interpretation of this is that this deals with a negotiation, not really with I don't see where an imminent danger to public health is created at the point at which this kind of dispute would arise. Am I misreading that somehow?
Mr. Chairman, it's one of those contingencies. You would hope that it never happens and that a pipeline operates beautifully all the time. But you're talking about a pipeline carrier that has contracts with multiple parties, and if something goes astray with the carrier in one party and they can't iron that out, and maybe it has to do with connecting new gas into the pipeline at a given time that's being counted on by someone at the end, or where it will interrupt the volume that's going to a public utility that needs it to fire their power plant. That's a hypothetical situation where something like that could happen.
Okay, understood.
Okay. The regulatory framework further sets some standards. The state of Alaska has never had a need for statutes regulating an open season to date. The feds have some statutes regulating an Alaska open season, but we realize something needs to be put in place here to make sure that the state also has open seasons that are fair and that are accessible, that people know about them and have an opportunity to participate. Therefore, this legislation, the regulatory framework, requires certain things. It requires that the carrier come up with its rules for an open season, and that they make those rules known, that those rules apply to all the people that come in an open season, and that everyone has that opportunity to know that the open season is happening. And then also, when there's new capacity down the line, or when there are expansions of a pipeline in the future, we require that there is an open season for that. It's an opportunity for people that that have thought about developing a project to get into the pipeline at a convenient time and make the most of any given expansion opportunity. Furthermore, the regulatory framework sets timelines that are intended to not interfere with the commercial processes. Again, this is a little bit of that balancing act. That's one reason that the precedent agreements, before they become final transportation agreements, are presented to the RCA. The RCA has an opportunity to approve them early on in the process, which means that the ultimate final agreements between the shippers and the pipeline carrier are not contingent on some future action of the RCA once the pipeline is flowing.
Mm-hmm.
And that was our overview of this legislation. I thank you. Happy to take any questions.
Good, thank you. Goodness. I guess I would make the opportunity available. We have Dan Fauske is on the line as well. And Mr. Fauske, I wonder if you have anything you'd like to add to the presentation that Ms. Delbridge and the speaker delivered so far. I just want to stand by for questions.
Mr. Chairman, can you hear me?
Yes, sir, we can.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is Dan Fauske, President of Alaska Gas Line Development. I enjoyed the presentation. I think most of the questions that arose will require further discussion as we go forward, and I thought Rena did a wonderful job, and I'm fine, Mr. Chairman, unless anyone has any questions of me.
Any questions? Either here or Representative Tower, do you have any questions?
Not at this time, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Okay. Good a slug of information. We still have a good 40 minutes. Would it be your preference? Anyone have other questions or discussion before we proceed to the sectional analysis? Okay. Having answered most of our questions, we can proceed to the scut work.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Your sectional analysis, of course, we've got the beginning of the bill title. Section 1 of the legislation expresses legislative findings and intent.
Pardon me, has everyone got the form or called up online? Okay, good. Yes. Sorry, here. Good. Lots of documentation. Thank you, Rena. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So Section 1 expresses the legislature's findings and intent. This section is where the finding is made that an AGDC natural gas pipeline is in the best interest of the state and required for the public convenience and necessity. As we just discussed, that works in conjunction with the regulatory framework. This legislation finds that it's the state's policy to make the state's royalty gas available to be shipped in an AGDC pipeline. royalty gas could be an important volume for a pipeline such as this. Please note, though, that this finding does not address the ownership of the state royalty gas or the sale, only the transportation of. Section 1 makes a finding that located in DDC under the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development for administrative purposes only will advance AGDC's mission. The sponsors...
Briefly, the italicized, is this kind of a parenthetical comment or expansion, elaboration on the main point?
Mr. Chairman, it's an attempt to explain the purpose for the legislative finding or intent.
I like it. Thanks.
And so locating AGDC under Department of Commerce will advance AGDC's mission. There's intent language provided that AGDC's transfer from its current position as an Alaska Housing Finance Corporation subsidiary to a standalone corporation is treated as a repositioning and not as creating a new entity. This intent is backed up, if you will, by transition language at the end of the bill that further articulates the sponsor's intent that AGDC does not need to dismantle itself as a corporation now and recreate itself somewhere else, but that we're simply moving AGDC from one spot to another, assets intact. House Bill 4, Section 1 provides intent that AGDC will procure services, labor, products, and resources from Alaska businesses, including specifically Native corporations and municipal organizations when prices are competitive. And there is, again, the intent we discussed earlier that AGDC will, as possible, hire Alaskans, establish hiring facilities in Alaska, and use the Department of Labor's hiring systems and job training systems. Section 2 is conforming.
Representative Duck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So with having AGDC be its own entity, and what's the advantage of going underneath the DCCED and not remaining under HFC? What's the what framework does DCCED have that HFC does not have?
Representative Clark, through the chair, the sponsors, AHFC has a wonderful framework. It's also the state's housing finance corporation, and has a basic mission that is admittedly unrelated to gas line development. Housing finance really did serve as a wonderful place to, again, incubate an idea, to name a team and to say, get a plan together. Let's see if this is possible. And again, now that this is possible, it's time for the state, in the sponsor's eyes, to get serious about it, to go ahead and create an entity that's charged with gas lines, that has the absolute mission and relevancy and experience to carry that out. The private sector that we're counting on as potential pipeline owner, joint owners, as shippers, as financiers, will react favorably to knowing that the state takes this so seriously, that it's willing to pull it out of housing finance and make it happen.
Follow, Mr. Chair.
Hello.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And why not Alaska Energy Authority? Why not AEA? It seems like that would be a more natural spot.
Representative Puff, through the chair, AEA is an authority. I actually am not sure that they can make subsidiary corporations or not. I would have to check into that. The sponsor settled on Commerce as a reasonable location. To them, an in-state gas pipeline is, in fact, all about our communities and about economic development, hopefully about commerce, commercializing part of the North Slope gas resource as well. A corporation like this, a standalone state corporation, has to go under something. Commerce was a logical choice for the sponsors. As a note, though, it is strictly for administrative purposes, which means only for any budget appropriations or requests that come down the road. There's no real management interface or policy interface.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Tuck.
Section 2 is conforming as we have enabled AGDC to stand on its own. Alaska Housing Finance Corporation no longer needs the ability to create gas line subsidiaries, so we delete that language from Alaska Housing Finance statutes. Mm-hmm. Section 3 is our new corporation. This is a very long section, maybe 20 plus pages. adding a new chapter, Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation, to AS 31 Oil and Gas. And this is, again, the new statutory authority for the standalone corporation. In the sectional, we generally looked strongly to AHFC statutory authority as a template, what kind of corporate baseline things were required. And so I have noted through the sectional where, if and where, and whether completely or in some form, we've pulled from AHFC statutes. Mm-hmm. So Section 3125.010 of Section 3 is sort of the structure. And this is what actually establishes AGDC as an independent public corporation of the state, located in Commerce, and then makes provisions for asset distribution upon termination.
What are the other state-owned corporations similar?
Well, you have the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. You have the Alaska Railroad. You have Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. I believe that there is a tobacco settlement corporation. Not positive there. You have the you have ADA, Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority, which is similar.
Okay.
I believe those are the main ones that I am aware of.
You you would have stumped me on the tobacco one, but that's what I was thinking too. Thanks.
Sure. Okay, so Section 3125.020 of Section 3 relates to the governing body of AGDC. We establish a five-member board of directors. They serve staggered seven-year terms. We wanted long terms because it's important to have some continuity in your leadership in place as you move through a project that is going to take a few years. Members are appointed by the governor and need to be confirmed by the legislature. In making appointments, the governor will consider expertise in natural gas pipeline construction, natural gas pipeline operation, and natural gas pipeline marketing, in finance, and in large project management. Members can be removed for a cause only, and vacancies are to be filled in the same way as the original appointments are made. The board members receive $400 compensation per day spent on official board business in addition to actual expenses. The $400 compensation per day is in line with the board compensation paid to both the Alaska Railroad Corporation and the Permanent Fund Corporation board members. Alaskan Housing Finance Authority board members are compensated at a substantially lower level.
Would there be any term limits for reappointment, the maximum two terms or one term or anything like that?
Mr. Chairman, there is no language related to term limits.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I see that if one of the board members can't be present, that they can designate a deputy. Now, is that in the? My question is: does that deputy then have to go to the other meetings just to make sure that they're up on everything, or?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, you're right. Most or many of the existing frameworks do allow a deputy to be appointed. I don't believe that this legislation allows for deputies to the board.
Okay.
That's often something that's done when there are commissioners on a board,
okay,
as in commissioners' interests and time is pulled in many different directions.
Okay. Right.
Representative Feige, question?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In establishing a five-member board, this is a project that could be fairly extensive in scope, fairly wide variety of professions, expertise is required. Is five members enough to give you the oversight for a project like that, or should it be seven? Should it be nine? Why did you all decide on five?
Representative Feige, through the chair. There was a lot of discussion among the sponsors as to what an optimal level of board members would be. There was a lot of consultation as well with people that have had experience in this, both with AGDC and with Alaska Housing Finance. Hmm. We turned to Dan Fauske and his experience somewhat in trying to get a sense of how big of a board is unwieldy versus how big of a board is too small to bring that relevant leadership and expertise to the process. Five members seemed a strong, intact board that would balance a strong executive director of an organization and work complementary in advancing something that way. The sponsors felt that with these five members and the specific expertise that the governor is to recruit from, that it was represented a very good range of expertise and leadership that would be able to move this project forward efficiently and quickly.
Okay. And would they be required to be Alaska residents? And then a question from Representative Tuck.
Mr. Chairman, no, there is no requirement that they be Alaskan residents. The sponsors would anticipate that some would be, but not all, and that the governor should have some leeway in his appointments so that he's able to find people with the greatest expertise to advance this project forward.
Thank you. Representative, I've got a question, then Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And how do you plan on staggering the five board members? Because I'm assuming they're all going to be starting at about the same time. And then how they get staggered, it's in the bill? Can you show me where that's at?
Excuse me just a moment while I locate it. There we are. Representative Tuck through the chair. Page 5, lines 6 through 9. The terms will be set by the governor to be 2 years for one member, 3 years for one member, 5 years for one member, and 7 years for two members.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. That's pretty standard staggering terms for an initial creation of a board, but yeah. That's why I asked if you want to have a second term allowed so the first person who comes on doesn't lose expertise, but we'll come up with that. Representative Feige.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I'm sorry. Representative Wilson was next.
Okay.
I yield.
thank you, Mr. Chairman. This appears to me that this is going to be really intense for the first several years, and, you know, saying $400 a day. I mean, sometimes they might have to work, I mean, every day of the month. And so that's like, I don't know what that comes out to be, but I mean, that, you know, at first, I can see that they might even have to work weekends, you know, to get this rolling and to get things going. How much does that come up to be if they, you know, I don't know. I haven't.
Representative Wilson through the chair. The board versus executive director structure was sort of built to try and make sure that we didn't have a board, that we had a strong executive director and strong management within the organization so that the board could act more as board members instead of hands-on daily affairs managers. It's always a little bit of a balancing act, I believe, for these corporations that have a board and an executive director to try and find out where the appropriate boundaries are there. There certainly are corporations in which your board members take up office space and need to be there every day and make sure that things are happening. Because of the balance and because of separations that we've put in so that the executive director is the one charged with running the actual corporation, we believe that that won't be a problem in this case.
Okay.
It's
like advisory board then?
Representative Wilson through the chair. No, it wouldn't be advisory. It would be expected, though, that the board's business is on given days when they're having board meetings and whatnot. I would actually like to be able to come back to you with information as to what kind of business they need to be doing outside of a formal meeting in order to claim that per diem.
Okay. That's fine.
And Representative Feige, patiently waiting.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Representative Wilson brings up a good point. Quite frankly, it's a $7 billion project. You want to get the best people you can overseeing it. And I would question if $400 a day enough. We want to be able to attract the best folks that we possibly can. And we need to compensate them for their time. So certainly $400 is not unreasonable. It's less than what a Twin Otter captain would make. So my question is, of the five-member board, that is a lean board, and judging you've got the basically five different specialties that the governor is supposed to pick from, I don't see anything in here that says you have to have, for a quorum to conduct business, that you have to have a minimum number. I would propose that quorum be five, that you'd have to have 100% attendance, just so you have input on all five major project areas.
Representative Feige, through the chair, that's an excellent suggestion. In the legislation right now, the quorum required for a meeting is three members, but the sponsors decided, much in your line of thinking, that this board is going to be making some very important decisions, significant decisions that Alaskans are really relying on. And therefore, for substantive matters, significant board matters, including bond issuances, whether or not to commit to a project, whether or not to transfer or dispose of parts of a project, a majority of the board is required for an affirmative vote, so that a minority of the board is not able to be a majority vote on an action that is of significance. Does that?
I'd still like to see all five. We can address that later.
Just for clarification,
Johnson.
You're talking about all five for a quorum, not for a vote.
For a quorum to conduct business, correct?
Okay.
Are there more questions about the board?
Seeing none.
Section 3125.030, meetings of the board, directs the board to elect officers annually, defines the quorum as a majority of members, and requires meetings at least once every 3 months. Electronic meetings are allowed. For a meeting in which the board authorizes the issuing of bonds, at least 24 hours public notice is required. At least three board members are required for major votes, including bond sales, disposition of assets, terminating an ownership structure, etc. Section 3125.035, meetings of minutes, requires the board to keep minutes. 3125.040, administration of affairs, essentially allows the board to manage the assets and the business of the corporation. This is where the board may adopt and amend and repeal bylaws and regulations. It will delegate corporate administration to the executive director. And as we have exempted AGDC from the procurement code as a backstop to ensure that people have fair opportunity to participate in procurement by AGDC, the board must adopt formal procedures governing the procurement process so that it is clear to anyone who is interested.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you. I want to go back up to meetings and the boards. I'm sorry I didn't get a chance to stop you. Electronic meetings are allowed. Does that include voting?
Yes, I believe it does. The same kind of notice and whatnot applies for electronic meetings. Let me get you a definitive answer here.
Because we can have electronic meetings, but they can't vote unless they're in attendance. So just to clarify that.
Representative Johnson, through the chair, under this legislation, the board may meet and transact business by electronic media. And so you would not necessarily have to have a board member present.
Okay, thank you.
Section 3125.045, executive director, requires an executive director who is appointed by and serves at the pleasure of the board. The director may not be a member of the board. 3125.050, legal counsel, directs the corporation to retain legal counsel. 3125.060, employment of personnel, allows the board to engage professional and technical consultants. It also allows the executive director to hire corporation employees and contract with consultants. And then the board also is to set the duties and the compensation for corporation personnel. 3125.065, personnel exempt from the State Personnel Act, exempts AGDC from the State Personnel Act.
Representative Fontaine, go ahead.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Being able to hire independent contractors and having your own procurement code. One of the things that we learned in a mega project class that we had is making sure that we have our own people have an oversight. Those that are going to be taking over the project, those are going to be maintaining it to make sure that they have proper oversight. And we see what's happening with the Port of Anchorage, with having independent contractors actually doing your quality control and doing your contracting and everything else. I just would like to, in the future, I know you're going to get it together for me, but I just want to reemphasize the reason why I want to see what is it about our state procurement code that is restrictive and does not allow this, and why wouldn't we just adopt the state procurement code? And because I believe it allows for almost every opportunity that you need to have as far as procuring both services and for materials. And so I just want to make sure that we're not going to get ourselves down, because that was one of the things that was emphasized in that mega project class is making sure you have proper oversight, making sure you have good, strong procurement codes. We saw what happened with the audit on Alaska Energy Authority, when they did not follow their own procurement codes, did not have best practices and everything else. I just want to make sure that we're not going to get ourselves in trouble.
Representative Tuck, through the chair, duly noted, and we will make sure that we get back to you with that information.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Tuck. I need to mention for the record it was actually MARAD, which is a federal agency, that was the overseer of that. I don't think it was the other contractor, but
I didn't mention a contractor's name, I don't believe.
Okay, no, but I think you said contractor. I think it's the federal government that's overseer, but all right, fair enough. Actually, I've got a question kind of on two things. Again, because the genesis of a lot of these sections is HFC regulations or operations, I just want to ask what the railroad ADA, et cetera, do for when it comes to legal counsel and personal act and so forth. So while we know what the HFC precedent is, just like to get your thoughts on what the other state-owned corporations do.
Mr. Chairman, each one has its own own similarities and differences. I will need to get back to you with a precise comparison for the procurement code. I will tell you that the Attorney General statutorily serves as legal counsel for most other public corporations of the state.
Okay. We keep stopping you, but go ahead now.
No problem. We've talked about employment of personnel and exemption from the State Personnel Act. We're moving on to 3125070, purpose. This, again, is what directs AGDC to advance an in-state natural gas pipeline as described in the project plan, with modifications as necessary, to get gas as soon as possible to Fairbanks, South Central, and other communities where possible, and to try and ship and deliver gas at commercially reasonable rates for utilities, for industrial customers, and for producers.
And I'm sorry, is there a distinction between commercially reasonable rates and lowest cost to consumers as laid out in the authorizing legislation? Two different terms?
Mr. Chairman, they are two different terms. Consumers and Alaskans that need an in-state energy solution need gas at the lowest possible rates. Mm-hmm. It seemed reasonable that this pipeline would need to present commercially reasonable terms to the people that would be using the pipeline, other than those people we're trying to get gas for in the end.
Okay, I'm seeing this. Sorry.
Okay. We move on to 3125080, powers and duties. This is again a long section listing 21 powers of the corporation. Some of these, as we discussed, are fairly boilerplate. Some of them are very relevant to AGDC. The corporation would have the ability to determine a pipeline ownership and operating structure, to plan, finance, construct, and operate a pipeline system, to lease, rent, acquire, or manage property, exercise eminent domain, transfer or dispose of all or part of a pipeline system, operate as a contract carrier, conduct hearings, sue and be sued, adopt bylaws, borrow money, and invest funds. And that is not comprehensive. That's sort of a flavor of what's in the powers and duties. This section prohibits development of a pipeline that competes under the terms of a GF, and it requires the publication of open season results. Section 3125090, confidentiality and interagency cooperation. This section allows state agencies to share information with AGDC. It requires state agencies to cooperate with AGDC and to give priority to AGDC's requests except for requests from the AGIA coordinator. It directs AGDC to avoid duplicating state work on a pipeline. It requires that state entities provide non-hydrocarbon resources like water, sand, and gravel to AGDC. AGDC is to pay normal customary costs, but those are not to be recovered in pipeline tariffs. This section says that DNR will grant AGDC a right-of-way lease at no appraisal or rental cost if the standard conditions are met for them to get the lease. The fee waiver there carries with the lease in case of a transfer, although those transfers need to be approved by the commissioner. AGDC can enter into confidential agreements as necessary, including with other state entities or the private sector. Information that's covered by a confidentiality agreement is not subject to disclosure under the State Public Records Act. AGDC can also keep some other information confidential, including the results of field studies, technical information, trade secrets, commercial negotiations. AGDC can waive confidentiality of some information when they see that that's in Alaskan's best interest and it doesn't conflict with the third party. Okay. 3125-100 creates the In-State Natural Gas Pipeline Fund within AGDC and directs its use. 3125-110, International Borrowing, gives AGDC the authority to access international capital markets to borrow money. 3125-120 allows AGDC to create subsidiary corporations to help AGDC meet its mission, including a subsidiary that would acquire and ship the state's royalty gas. It allows a subsidiary, together with the DNR commissioner, to pledge state royalty gas to honor delivery commitments. The DNR commissioner, of course, gets to decide how much gas to pledge and at what price.
Would the authority actually be from the DNR commissioner? Is that the transfer of... That seems to be a pretty important transfer of rights to a subsidiary or organization. How would that work?
The language in the bill would allow an AGDC subsidiary to make commitments to ship the state's royalty gas, and then would allow DNR and the authority together to pledge gas to meet those commitments. And so the subsidiary would need to know that it has gas available, but then it would be between the subsidiary and DNR to decide, in fact, that this gas is available for shipment.
So I'm still a little unclear. Wouldn't the commissioner have the authority to decide how to dispose of state royalty gas? And if it coincided with what was in the interest of AGDC, that would work. But it sounds like you're saying the subsidiary of AGDC has the right to tell the commissioner he shall dedicate royalty gas. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, there is a may. The commissioner may pledge state royalty gas to honor those commitments that the subsidiary makes. There is no shall. You're right. It is absolutely the DNR commissioner's authority to decide, along with, I think, the state's royalty gas board, how the state's royalty gas is managed. The language in this bill does provide for the commissioner to treat disposals to treat management of royalty gas through an AGDC subsidiary as a disposal for other purposes, which means that they don't need to go out to competitive bid or follow those kinds of regulations for those quantities.
So one would assume that the AGDC subsidiary would not negotiate that in isolation from the DNR commissioner, but this would allow the DNR commissioner the ability to say no, and then they would have to clean up the mess on the other end with the subsidiary.
Okay. 3125-130 exempts AGDC from the Administrative Procedure Act, except for the Open Meetings Act portion. It provides board direction related to bylaws, regulations, and public notice of meeting. This is very similar to what's in Alaska Housing Finances statutes, but it's been tailored by removing parts that relate very specifically to extending housing loans. 3125-140 exempts AGDC and its subsidiaries from the State Procurement Code and the Executive Budget Act. It does require an annual independent audit and publication of financial records to the governor, the legislature, and Alaskans. 3125-150 provides that if the interest on bonds or notes becomes taxable under federal income tax laws, the legislature may pay off the principal and interest of AGDC bonds. And this section creates a moral but not a legal obligation of the state. It serves as a reassurance for lenders who are counting on the tax-exempt quality of revenue bonds, that if the if the federal government changes the game plan in a way that changes the value of those bonds, that the state will step in and pay those off. 3125-160, bonds and notes, allows the corporation to issue bonds and notes in one or more series limited to the corporation's own backing. With this section, again, AGDC can issue revenue bonds to meet its purpose of financing a gas pipeline, and that's supported by the anticipated revenue from the pipeline that's evidenced in those long-term shipping contracts. 3125-170, independent financial advisor, allows the corporation to retain a financial advisor in negotiating the private sale of bonds or notes to an underwriter. The way that this was explained to me is that oftentimes that underwriter has a stake in the game and would like to see things done a certain way, and that when AGDC can bring in its independent advisor, that person's stake in the game is simply advising its client and provides a nice balance to that to make sure that AGDC's interests are well represented.
Thank you. Going back one item to the bonds and notes section, the phrase limited to the corporation's own backing, I'm not familiar with the terms. What would be that practical limit?
Mr. Chairman, it means that AGDC can't promise the state's faith and credit. It means that AGDC and AGDC alone is responsible for those bonds.
Okay.
3125-180, validity of pledge, declares as valid and binding any pledge of assets or revenues that the corporation makes to payment or interest on those bonds. And this is a standard statement that lenders need to see. It essentially assures lenders that AGDC has the statutory authority to pledge revenue. In turn, that protects AGDC's contracts under the U.S. Constitution's Contracts Clause so that future legislative action by the state cannot violate those contracts. 3125-190 allows AGDC to establish capital reserve funds to secure its obligation and directs fund management. It requires annual reports to the governor and to the legislature on the status of this fund. Again, this section includes a moral but not a legal obligation of the state to replenish, if necessary and up to any given threshold, a reserve fund that's created to cover interest payments that are due on the bonds. 3125-200, remedies, permits enforcement of rights by those that hold AGDC obligations. Again, this is sort of a standard statement that these lenders need to see.
Thank you. A question, Representative Wilson?
Thank you. I want to go back to Section 190. Kind of explain to me, doesn't have a legal obligation, but it does have a moral obligation. That means that, does that mean legally you don't have to do it, but you better?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, while we can't bind, we're not binding the state or a future legislature of the state to appropriating money to do something, and therefore it's not a legal obligation. It's a moral obligation in the sense that we have said that the state may do this in the future, which is creating that moral obligation by demonstrating that it's your intent now that in the future that does occur.
Okay. Representative Wilson, follow up.
So my statement was correct.
Okay, great.
Thank you.
Ms. Delbridge, at this point, it's 3:25, and these are some pretty juicy, important sections, and we're at the end of a kind of a long thing. I want to take some time to digest this. So, with your indulgence, I'd like to just establish right here, and we'll probably bring the bill up again under bills previously heard. A lot of good information. It's going to require some A-Bing and some thought. So, also given that we've lost a couple members, I want to make sure everyone has the opportunity to hear your presentations, which are very thorough.
Absolutely. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Committee.
Speaker, so. With the time, we're out of time. We're going to take the bill up again real soon, I'm sure. Our next meeting is scheduled for 1 o'clock on Wednesday, the 6th of February. We'll take up bills previously heard. And we are adjourned at 3:26.